Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome. This is Robert Forto, and you are listening to Mush You Huskies, brought to you by Native Performance Dog Food and Twine Group Media. I am calling in from Willow, Alaska, and on the line is our co-host, Michelle. How are you?
I'm doing great.
How is it in Denver here on this Iditarod Start weekend here in Alaska?
You know, we were slated to receive a couple of inches of snow today, and it stayed in the high country, and we did have a few snowflakes fly in the gleaming sunlight. It was a gorgeous day, but it was windy.
Well, you never know what to expect either in Alaska or in Denver. And I tell you, it's quite warm here in Willow. It's about 20 degrees, and some of the Iditarod guys were even saying the snow is melting faster than it falls. So we're looking forward to seeing how the race unfolds here at the start on Sunday here in Willow. But to do that, we have a special guest for Mush You Huskies for the next couple of weeks. Our expert, our Iditarod expert, his name is Jason Barron, and we've had him on the show about 2 months ago to talk about his book, Ballad of the Northland. And he is calling in from Lincoln, Montana. He is a seven-time Iditarod finisher, as well as multiple championships in the Race to the Sky race, as well as the John Bear Grease Marathon, which are held down in the lower 48 states. I believe they are qualifiers still for the Iditarod. And we want to welcome Jason Barron. Jason, how are you?
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me and having me on your show. I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to the next couple of weeks.
I am too. You know, this is just a thought that came to me early this morning as I was reading through some of your blogs about this race and the madness of the Iditarod, and I just thought, what a better person to have on than somebody that has not only finished the race seven times, but also was the Rookie of the Year and is a very accomplished writer. So I think that we need to bring you on and really get our listeners what this race is all about. So if you will, Jason, to start us off, what makes a musher a musher? Who are you in relation to this sport?
Well, what makes a musher is, especially in the context of the Iditarod, is a form of craziness. You know, for starters, it isn't just professionals out here doing this. I mean, it's people from all different walks of life. I mean, I've seen more than one doctor, lawyer, you know, types that have sort of came to see the race and then ended up, you know, being an Iditarider. And then after a couple of years, all of a sudden they're like living in Alaska or they're living in some northern state with a bunch of dogs and they're putting their career on the skids while they chase the Iditarod dream. So there's all different types, all the way up to you know, the grand champion, the grand masters of the sport, guys like Lance Mackey, four-time Iditarod champion, you know, the 600-pound gorilla that I was writing about a little earlier today, that you know, essentially have turned this into their what they do exclusively for their living.
And, you know, Jason, I am neighbors currently with Bob Story. He is a 65-year-old New Zealander who is trying to harness that dream of running the Iditarod. And I often meet him on the trails here behind the house, and he's running his team. He's working with Iditarod veteran Vern Halter. And he has told me on numerous occasions that this is a form of madness. And just a little bit of history about Bob is, he started this, just like you said, he had a show dog or two. He started going down to the dryland races in his native New Zealand. And the next thing you know, he's telling his wife, we've got to move to Alaska. We've got to run the Iditarod.
it just gets worse from there. That's what you should
it
tell
does,
me.
It does. So, and like you said, there are so many people that do this for a living, that this is their full-time profession. But there are many of us that start in this very simple way of you know, just doing a sprint race or two, then, you know, two dogs becomes four, becomes eight, becomes 50. Mm-hmm. And before we know it, we're in the craziness there in downtown Anchorage, which is going to happen, I believe, at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. And I'm looking forward to being down there. So if you will, Jason, tell us a little bit about that madness of the ceremonial start in Anchorage.
Well, I sure will. To follow up on that thought a little bit, you're a great example of what we're talking about—the people getting kind of sucked into that madness. I mean, you're on your journey as a future Iditarod driver, so I can already hear it happening in your voice. But, it's going to be utter pandemonium. You've got something like 66 drivers. They're all going to, I think each one of them is bringing 20 dogs in their truck. They're only going to run 12 dogs tomorrow. Starting at 10 o'clock, the first driver is going to take off. And then at two-minute intervals, they're going to, you know, one after the other, going to take off. And they're only going to be driving 12 dogs apiece. I think they're mandated to carry us. They have a second sled, meaning they have a handler that's on a sled that's kind of pulled along behind their primary sled. And then they have an Iditarider, somebody who's auctioned off a ride in their sled. And, you know, some of those rides are pricey. I saw something like close to $250,000 have been raised in Iditaride, $180,000 in Iditaride auction ride. So, you know, that's going to be happening. But 20 dogs times 66 drivers, and because they have to bring their entire pool, whether they use them or not, they have to bring their entire pool to 4th Avenue. And it's going to be really, really noisy. I mean, that's the first thing that strikes you if you've never been to the Iditarod start before, when you're first there, especially on 4th Avenue and all the little side streets like C, B, and A, is that there's all the buildings around there, and they really channel that noise like down like these concrete canyons. And I tell you what, all of those dogs are going to be barking and screaming. People are going to be hollering. It really is pandemonium.
And people come from all over the world to take part in this event. I remember talking to people last year at the banquet. People make this their year-long vacation to come up here and watch this start. What is the attraction to something like this? Very many people don't know about, you know, dog sledding other than seeing it on movies and, you know, maybe reading a book or two about it or a magazine article. Why do people fly from all over the world to come up and see an event like this?
Well, I think it's a fairly complex question, because I think there's a lot of reasons people come to be a part of it. But I'll name a couple of the biggies. Number one, it's one of the last great adventures. You know, it's a throwback to a Jack London-esque kind of era where people still sort of think about Yukon, Klondike, gold, and the spirit of Sam McGee and Robert Service poetry and, you know, the old sourdough trappers out there just like carving a niche out of the wilderness. So it's this adventure that the mushers and the Iditarod kind of embody as a way to tap into that. And I think that's the biggest reason why. I mean, look, I think that's the reason why a lot of people became Iditarod mushers in the first place and were attracted to it, was because of that Jack London-esque sort of theme and need for adventure. Is the fact that it's a race is only part of it. The competition only really hints at what really is going on at a deeper level, and that is the ability to reach out there. In this manner, I think the mushers and the fans that have flown from all over the world, all over the country, they share that in common. It's just that they have a different ways of accessing it. The mushers, of course, have their dog teams. They're going to run the race. The fans, you know, have real lives. They can only be fans, but they want to be a part of it nonetheless. And that's the part that they can access the easiest. You know, they can't really be out on the trail. They don't have dog teams. So they're reaching out and touching the part of it that they can. And it is to be a part of that larger-than-life adventure that's a throwback to a bygone age that's, you know, it's getting paved over and homogenized and it's still alive and well up in Alaska.
Well, speaking of that adventure, hold on just a second, Michelle, before you pipe in there. Speaking of that adventure, that's what you convey in your book, that the book Ballad of the Northland. It's truly an adventure from a musher's perspective as growing up as a little kid here in Alaska.
Oh, absolutely. You know, what I did was in the book Battle of the Northland, I actually went back in time and told the story that was a little more relevant to my youth, and I kind of fictionalized my youth growing up in the bush of Alaska. And what I tried to do is I tried to show the audience, the reader, what the price that mushers, you know, pay for their kind of obsession and their madness, especially the ones who are completely obsessed with winning at all costs. And the ones that form these, they sort of shun civilization and form complex relationships with their dogs and their canine teammates, as opposed to joining up civilization and having normal jobs and carrying out a 9-to-5 kind of existence. They have a completely different methodology, and I try to show that relationship between the dogs and the human beings and Mother Nature, the Northland, and basically show a really unvarnished picture of what it's like to, you know, pay the price that us professional mushers and the ones who've done this our whole lives have paid.
Right, right. And you can definitely pick that book up just about anywhere on any of the bookseller sites, as well as right here on our Blog Talk Radio page, blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. Michelle, you have a question?
Well, I actually have a few things that I wanted to try to discuss, because y'all are mushers and I'm not. So I kind of have, I don't know, I guess a different perspective that I can bring to the table tonight. Because even though I've been behind a dog sled or two, it's always been sprint racing, so I don't consider myself a musher at all. But, you know, I've spoken with a lot of our clients during this week that think that you're running the Iditarod tomorrow. And I've also spoken to a lot of people in and around our business here in Denver this week that have asked me, hey, I saw that Facebook post of yours. What is the Iditarod? I mean, it's almost like it's mythical, like a unicorn or something that people think that only exists in movies and storybooks, but they don't understand that it's still a real event that people partake in for whatever reason. So maybe both of you can touch on what is Iditarod.
Jason, before you get started there, as I've had to talk about on several occasions on posts, a lot of people don't understand that it takes years to qualify for this race. It's not something you can just move up to Alaska with a dog truck and a dog or two and expect to run the race the following spring. It has to do with quite a few qualifiers, as well as all sorts of hoops you have to jump through and sponsors you have to have, etc. And that's the process that I'm in, and I'm still at least a year or two off from even applying to see if I'll be accepted for that race. Jason, your comments, please.
Well, I'm not sure I understood that exactly, what Michelle was asking me, but I'll do my best to answer it. Is that it's a 1,000 mile race set in the interior of Alaska, starts in Anchorage and runs all the way to the gold fields in Nome. It's 1,000 miles, almost 1,100 miles, and it's a race where you have it's all dog power. It's one driver, man or woman. You know, anybody can enter the race, assuming that they're qualified. And just like you said, you know, you have several years worth of qualifications, and that isn't exactly encouraging you, even though you're just barely qualified. Nobody's really encouraging you just to get in there just because you are barely qualified. You know, that's only just the sort of the minimum requirements. I mean, obviously, you want to get your, you know, and I'm not talking about you per se. I'm just talking about people that are, you know, listening and maybe thinking about someday they'd like to run the Iditarod, is hone your skills and just, you know, get as much experience as you can racing as many races as you can get to before you actually get to the granddaddy of them all. And it's a 1,000-mile race. That's not the Tour de France. It doesn't have stages. It's a continual race. There are some mandatory layovers, but for the most part, it is a race that when the clock starts for you on the Sunday in Willow, when it restarts, it doesn't end until you cross the finish line. And you can pull into checkpoints and take a little bit of rest or none at all and continue on into the night. And, you know, it's a race where all different strategies of running take place. You know, some people go out there and they take a lot of rest and go really fast in between shorter points. Some people can go out there on that same trail and take very little rest and go much slower, but then they can keep that up for longer. And, you know, it's a constantly evolving sport. But basically, it's you, the driver, stands on the back of a sled with 16 dogs in front of you, and those dogs are responsible, and you both, you know, you and your dogs are responsible for getting yourselves to Nome. You can start with 16 dogs, but, and when I said 20 earlier, that is a pool you can draw from. To tomorrow, for instance, is the ceremonial start, is that the race will start in Anchorage. It'll go 12 miles. You have a pool of 20 dogs, and what that means is you can pick your favorite 16 out of that pool on Sunday when the race restarts for what we call for real. And then at that point, your 16 dogs are responsible for getting you in your sled and your gear to Nome, and you cannot ever gain dogs, but you can drop them as they become, you know, tired, or if someone gets a minor injury or something, you can always drop them out of your team and send them home. But you can never
get
them back.
What is the minimum that you have to finish with, if there is one?
Well, it's changed from year to year. I think this year it's 8. But I don't want to be nailed down 100%. It's possible it's 5. I mean, many years it's been 5 dogs minimum. I mean, I would say that 9 to 10 dogs is a good average number to come into Nome with.
And what is the appropriate time for, you know, the middle of the pack mushers, the guys that, you know, they want to win, but they just don't have the ability to. How long is it going to take these guys to get from Willow to Nome?
Well, I think that, you know, we're going to look for the champion, the winners, to get in there around 9 days, the low 9-day mark. If it's really horrible weather, 9.5 days. And we're going to look at the very tail end of the race, I would think, is going to be about 14 to 15 days, probably under 15. And the middle of the packers are going to be spread out all across that barrier, you know. I would say that a good driver who's being non-competitive but running a really competent race is between 11 and 12 days.
And for people that don't quite understand that, think about taking a 2-week vacation with very little sleep, 50 mile an hour winds, and possibly 50 below zero between you and your dogs, and just about nothing else. And that is that's the pace for a lot of Iditarod mushers. Can you explain a little bit about that, Jason? Just how long that 10, 11, 12 days really is?
Well, it seems like it takes forever, because when the race takes off out of Anchorage, you know, and out of Willow on Sunday, you're leaving the last sort of points of what most people consider civilization. And while you do come into small communities and villages and whatnot on, as you proceed down the trail, there are checkpoints. And they're still like interior villages where they're, generally speaking, they're either Athabascan or they're Eskimo villages where you don't feel like you're coming into some normal, you know, some town that, you know, most people have in their experiences. You're coming into you know, something that makes you feel like you are truly in a different country. And the 10 or 12 or 14 days that the race takes sort of feel much longer, because they become the only world that you really know. I mean, it gets to the point where remembering the land of satellite television and cell phones and Walmart becomes sort of almost like absurd. They're so out of context that they're absurd. And when you're going down the trail, you sort of forget that stuff is even really out there, and you become focused on the wilderness you know, and basically just this journey, this personal journey. It's also much longer than it seems, because, and I got to really focus on this, is because you're not getting any sleep. That isn't just like 10 or 12 normal days where you're getting 8 hours of sleep a day. You might only be getting 90 minutes to 120 minutes a day, out of a day being a 24-hour period. So that's almost around the clock. See, what a lot of people don't understand is that the driver is completely responsible for the care of all of their dogs. So what that means is when you pull into, you might do a 7 or 8, 9 hour run and pull into a checkpoint or a place where you're going to take a break, and you don't have like a little army of people showing up to like take the work off your hands and let you go get some rest while they take care of your dogs and your equipment. You have to do everything. You have to feed, you have to water, you have to mend anything that's wrong with your sled, you have to decide and make critical decisions on the care of your animals, critical decisions on the competition and the strategy and so forth. And what happens, you pull into a checkpoint, you might have a schedule, you might be scheduling 5 or 6 hours of rest there when you only get maybe 30 minutes to maybe 90 minutes of sleep, because on either side of that sleep, you're either getting camped or you're getting out of your camp. So that, you know, that 10 or 12 days that the race could take becomes an infinity after a while.
And that's one of the reasons why I titled this show Iditarod Madness. Not only the madness of what's going on downtown, but the madness of the race itself. And when you talk about that sleep deprivation and just how people struggle with little to no sleep, and all of our listeners know what I'm talking about. When they've stayed up too late and they have to get up early to go to work the next morning, and say they went to bed at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and had to get up at 8, they are physically exhausted when they go to work, and they're slamming Starbucks and everything else. Just thinking about doing that for 10 or 11 days in the elements with your dog team, it truly can drive a person dang near mad, can't it?
Well, I mean, it can certainly test your resolve, you know, and I think that's one of the things that really, really, the top drivers in the field are, you know, really makes them so special, is because now imagine that you're fundamentally, profoundly exhausted. It's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and you've stumbled into some gymnasium or some little cabin or something where they, you know, where the checkpoint, they may have some place where you can get out of the wind. And it's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. You are very tired. Your dogs are resting and you've got them camped. You take care of yourself and you know you're only going to get about 90 minutes of sleep before you have to get up. And now it's only 3 o'clock in the morning and you've got to get back out there and do it again. And it's howling wind. It's, you know, 50 below with the wind chill factor, poor visibility. And you've heard that the trail markers are in poor shape. So even finding your way out of the checkpoint out into some howling blizzard is kind of a daunting emotionally and spiritually and physical challenge. To having the resolve to get up there and do it while you are as tired as you've ever been or ever could conceive of being in your life. That is something that happens constantly in the Iditarod. That's what the Iditarod's all about.
And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, Jason, about in one of the Iditarod videos, I believe it's 2010, where Martin Bucer's coming into the checkpoint and you get the dinner if you get there first, the big steak dinner.
Yeah.
And the kind of the look on his face was, just let me go to sleep. Thanks for the dinner. Thanks for all of this. But there's cameras everywhere. There's media everywhere. And he's got this huge spread of steak and, you know, all the fixings. And it just looks
first
like he's utterly
UConn, yeah.
Exhausted.
Yeah, you know, I've never been in a position to receive that award. The first driver to reach the Yukon, and, you know, over the years, you know, it's been various drivers have attained that honor, and that's a little over halfway in the race. And by that point, yeah, I mean, you pull in and you're just exhausted, and they try to make a ceremony out of it because you're in the village and they bring everybody's in there to kind of take pictures and get autographs and stuff, and you know, it's there is a race going on and you have to do your part. But yeah, those mushers who get in there first, well, you know, like I said, I've never won that award, but I've often thought, oh boy, I bet that I'm going to be really tired after I leave that checkpoint, because I'm not going to get any, instead of getting my 2 hours of sleep, I'm not going to get any sleep if I happen to win that award. So yeah, absolutely.
Michelle, question?
Not at this time. I mean, I'm listening to what you guys are saying as an outsider, and I mean, you guys have to realize people want to be fans of Iditarod, but a lot of them don't understand what it is about at all. They cannot fathom in their mind 16 dogs, let alone 90 minutes of sleep. So a lot of times people, they don't have an understanding of why would you even do this. They understand the Tour de France. That they can understand. They understand NASCAR. They understand basketball and football and, you know, and even they understand triathlons and marathons, but they don't understand Iditarod. Why in the world would you want to go to negative 50 when you can go to the beach and be much better off on your vacation?
You know, that's a good point. You know, I remember when I was doing a lot of skydiving, people would always say, well, why do you want to jump out of a perfectly good airplane? And I used to tell them all the time, it's the thrill of whether I'm going to make it to the bottom. And I think that's what a lot of the Iditarod and a lot of mushers think about. It's that quest, isn't it, Jason? That quest to live this lifestyle, to get up every morning and take care of your dogs and be out there on the trail with them and have that bond. Isn't that what the Iditarod is showcasing and what this sport is all about?
Well, I think it is, and it goes and it goes back to what I said earlier. It is, it's like the Call of the Wild meets Iron Will, and then you can be a part of it. I mean, I guess part of the part of what I would say to your audience is that it is a tough adventure, and it's like nothing else in the world. I mean, there is no other sporting event like it, and there are no other athletes like mushers or there is nothing like a sled dog. I mean, there is no other athlete, human or otherwise, on the face of the planet who can match the endurance of a sled dog. And one of the reasons I think that I'm attracted to the sport, I know that the real, you know, the real dog people who've been doing this for years and just are completely hooked would all agree with this, is because that connection with not only these the land and the, you know, the Northland and the trails and the epic scenery and all the kind of adventure that we get to be a part of, is also the dogs. Those dogs are amazing, and I think that most people who are listening to this program probably all have at least, you know, a pet or two, if not more, and just imagine 16 dogs that are just powerful, trained to the peak of perfection. Each one of them is a Lance Armstrong, and they're all hooked up and they're all working with you. You're all connected, and they're all pulling you down the trail. It's like being hooked up behind a big storm of some kind. I mean, you're riding behind, you're hooked up into a blizzard that's dragging you along. It's a feeling that nothing else can give you, and I think that's a huge part of it. And it's always, at least for me, that I have this bond and this connection with these animals, and I'm sharing this adventure with them. It is like something out of a story or out of a movie. I mean, it really is an incredible experience that I'm lucky to have experienced once, much less 7 times.
I totally agree with you, Jason. We have about 4 minutes left, and what I would like to do here on the first show is get some predictions. All three of us know most of the mushers by name, and of course, you and I have met a lot of these guys and gals. Let's go with Michelle first. Who do you think is going to win the 2011 Iditarod, Michelle?
You know, I've been watching a lot of the mushers during the Yukon Quest. And now I realize not all the mushers that are running Iditarod participated in the Yukon Quest, but, you know, I'm kind of partial to Hugh Neff this year. I think he might, if he can't finish first, then he might be able to finish in top 5 this year. And so I'm rooting for him. I'm thinking Lance Mackey is maybe going to pull it out and have that 5th win, but you know, I just hope for the best for everybody and that everybody's able to finish.
Jason, what are your thoughts? I know you released a blog post about it just a little while ago about who you think are going to give a real tough run at it. Who are you thinking are going to be in the top 5 this year?
Well, I think Lance Mackey is, you know, he's won 4 in a row. He's publicly stated that he's in the best shape and his team is in the best shape of, you know, of his career. So, you know, automatically, you know, you have to just kind of put him there and say, look, everybody's got to go through him. So I sort of set that aside and go, okay, fine. I mean, how can you not say that you know, that he isn't really the main candidate, the smart money's on him. But with that said, every year that he wins, the odds go up against you failing somehow. Now, so I have a little list of drivers who I think are the ones I'm going to look at the closest in my blog, and the ones who I pick as being the types of drivers who are smart, resourceful, fantastic dog teams, every bit as good a mushers as Lance, if they don't have as strong a team, but they're certainly as good as he is and as savvy as he is. I think that Paul Gebhardt is my pick for winning the Iditarod this year. I think Paul is going to be a major kind of if Lance makes any mistake out there, I think that Paul is going to be out there to capitalize on it. And I'm going to put Dallas Seavey. I'm going to the quest that Michelle was mentioning. I'm going to pick Dallas Seavey. He runs a real conservative race. I think that he was, you know, a good example of what I'm talking about, picking up the pieces, would be Hugh, who, in my opinion, ran much too hard, which led to his demise on Eagle Summit when his team couldn't finish the race, essentially. I think the reason for that is because he got that 10 or 12-hour lead that he had on the quest because he was skipping rest, and his team, you know, basically wasn't strong enough to continue under those conditions. And Dallas Evie just kind of came dancing along and picked up the pieces. I think Dallas is definitely a candidate for doing something like that in the Iditarod, but running maybe a much stronger race to begin with, not being that far behind. And then I think John Baker is the next guy, and then Ken Anderson. Those are my 5 picks.
And I have to agree with you. Those are all excellent picks. I was looking through your list when I was reading through your blog, and I agree with you. I think the youngster with Dallas, he's a very young man, I believe 23 years old. He has a chance this year, as well as many. As I wrote about this morning, there's only 62 mushers this year and only 13 rookies. So I think that this race is really up to just about anyone, and anyone can take it. Agree or disagree, Jason?
Well, absolutely. That's the thing. It's all we can do is assess, you know, assessing who's going to win the Iditarod based on the strength of their team going into the race. It's like trying to assess who's going to win the Super Bowl based on who's strong in the preseason. I mean, there's so many things that can happen between the I mean, it's such a cliche, but it's true. There's so many things that can happen. You know, like Lance Mackey, for instance, he probably has the strongest team going in the race, but he has no power over whether his team gets a cold. I mean, plenty of teams are knocked out of competition because they get a cold. They get some sort of little virus that goes to the team and knocks them out of the competition. Well, you don't have any power. You can't train for that. You can't want or will your way out of getting a sick team. So you just one example of what could happen to anybody out there. So yes, I mean, I think the way I look at it is Lance Mackey has had the strongest group of dogs. That is what I think the defining characteristic of his winning streak has been. He's got the strongest group of dogs by far, and he is one of the best drivers in the business. And I think that if any one of these other drivers that I just mentioned had a team as strong as his, canines who were grouped together in front of their sleds as strong as his, as resilient as his, I think they could have their four wins in a row too. So all it takes is something to impair the health of his team, and I think someone like Dallas Eby could come along and compromise him just fine. And with that said, that could happen to anybody, and we have no way of predicting. All we can do is predict who's strong going into the race and then watch as it develops. I can tell you that with my blog and what I'm going to do on this show is I will help the audience. Hopefully you guys all go out and register for the Iditarod Insider. Go out there. I'll help you parse all the information. It'll get very complicated, but I'm going to help everybody make sense of what's happening in the front of the group. Plus, in my writing on my blog, I'm going to be paying a lot of attention to the middle and the back of the pack, the driver, some of the stories that aren't catching the headlines. I'm going to try to work on that a bit too to share with people.
And, you know, that's why I wanted you to have you on this show. I think that your expert analysis will really help people understand that. And like you said, that Iditarod Insider is a great program to be a part of. And even if you're just a fan of a lot of these guys on Facebook, you can get so much information just by following it on a site like Facebook. And there's so many trail updates and blogs and commentary.
Absolutely.
Back and forth, and most of these guys are on there, and of course their wives, handlers, other folks that they are a part of will give updates on the trail. So Jason, tomorrow is the ceremonial start. I'll be down there for that. We're going to try to do another show at about 6 o'clock Mountain Time, which would be 8 o'clock in the East and 4 o'clock up here in Alaska. What do you want to cover tomorrow to give people a little bit of a head start here?
Well, I think we should talk a little bit more about the competition as it's shaping up. I'm hoping I can get a weather report for that whole Matanuska Valley region for the first day or two of the race. We'll talk about really what kind of conditions the mushers are going to be going out into. And I think that to help the folks that Michelle was talking about that have a hard time picturing the race, I think we should tomorrow, before the action really starts to heat up, I think we should kind of step-by-step walk people, the audience, through what the first day, once the drivers take off out of out in the Yentna River and out past Squintna, what the topography's like and what the drivers are going to face on their first night.
And go ahead, Michelle.
I think that, Jason, you're not in Alaska right now, correct?
I'm in Lincoln, Montana.
Right. But what I'm saying is you're not there for the race. I think that Robert can help give us a perspective as well, because he's in Willow. He's 5 minutes from the start. He's going to be down in Anchorage tomorrow. So, you know, I think that we can get a little bird's eye perspective from him as well, which will help, people that are talking to me going, well, what is it? Why is he wanting to do this? You know, they think that my husband's having a midlife crisis, and they have no idea that he's been wanting to do this since he was 25.
Well, I'll do my best to give a good update until all of the mushers leave the start, and then after that, as Jason said, you're pretty much out of touch of civilian world as soon as you hit the river there, which is only about 8 miles from the Willow Community Center, where it starts. And the only updates that we're going to have are through the reports from the checkpoints and on the Iditarod Insider and things like that. So I look forward to this. I think this is going to be a great time. This show will really evolve over the next couple of weeks, at least until the leaders get in, the first the batch of guys. We're going to try to do this show every night, and I am so happy to have Jason on as our expert commentator for this race. We couldn't have a better guy. Jason, what do you want to close with this evening?
Well, I just want to close with telling the audience that I'm looking forward to trying to break this down and make this more understandable for you. And this is my first year in quite some time setting it out, and I'm excited to be a part of it from this perspective. I'm going to be writing on my blog, Mr. Jason Barron at WordPress.com, and I'm sure that information on Robert on his various sites will link to that. But between Robert, my blog, Facebook, and this show, we're going to do our best to make sure you understand, and if you feel like you did run the Iditarod by the time it's all over.
I look forward to it. Michelle, we'll talk to you tomorrow. Jason, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you about the same time tomorrow night. Is that good?
That sounds perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mush You Huskies, brought to you by Twine Group Media. We will be back tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter or just about anywhere else. Just type in Dog Works Radio in the search bar, and you can even download this show in iTunes. And if you like what you hear, you can also purchase Jason's book on our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. For Jason Barron and Michelle Forto, this is Robert Forto. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.